So in this second Metta retreat, we've come together here in this place from all over the world. It's really quite remarkable. Here in this half of the month that we're cultivating Metta here in Myanmar, there are people from 17 different countries, all over the world. We come from different cultures, maybe different religious backgrounds, different social backgrounds. And I think it's so fitting that we're here doing this together, because this benevolent and caring quality of metta that Saito has been describing, that is the benevolent heart, is what opens to our common humanity, what opens us to what we have in common to all living beings. Not just human beings, but non-human beings. This great commonality that we all share as abiding in this realm, in this world. There's so much more that we have in common then separates us. So cultivating the kind heart, walking the way of peace, I find it so incredibly moving, especially when you consider the world as it is today. So in the last talks, Saito has given complete instructions in the traditional Burmese way, which, when he does this, he assumes quite a lot of background and context that every Burmese person knows from, they're taught from when they're little. We're not. Coming from where we come from. So now for several days, Ariya and I will offer a little bit of background and a little bit of context in various aspects of this metta as it is and the practice, what it is to walk this way of peace. Filling in and explaining both about the metta and about the path, so that we as Westerners can understand it in our own language and in our own idiom. A number of people have asked us a number of questions, and so using some of these questions today as the starting point of this filling in. So we're all together here in this meditation center in Myanmar. And the practice that Saito has shared is an integral part of the Burmese Buddhist tradition and of the Buddhist path. And here, as I've said, it's taught in that very traditional way. But at the outset, it's really worth remembering that metta, this quality of kindness, of benevolence, of tender, caring interest, it's not Buddhist, per se. Buddhism doesn't own metta. It's universal. All great religious traditions teach kindness, teach unity. Here in this tradition, as in the chant that we chanted last night, to all as to myself is one articulation of that. Knowing that we want to be happy, knowing how we individually can suffer, we use that understanding as an empathetic bridge to others. Just as I want to be happy, so may you be happy, to all beings as to myself. Coming from the Christian tradition, this is not unfamiliar. There is the golden rule: do unto others as you would have done unto you. Same thing. In Judaism, also, what is hateful to you, do not do to your fellow. This is the whole Torah. The rest is explanation. Same thing. In Islam, that which you want for yourself, seek for mankind. Same thing. In Hinduism, one should never do that to another which one regards as injurious to one's own self. This, in brief, is the rule of Dharma. Other behavior is due to selfish desires. Same thing. From the Tao Te Ching, the sage has no interest of his own, but takes the interests of the people as his own. He is kind to the kind. He is also kind to the unkind. For virtue is kind. Same thing. Every single religious tradition teaches this as a core teaching, a core truth. And there are many ways to arrive at universal kindness. This, as it's taught here in the Buddhist tradition, is one. No matter what religious tradition we dwell in, if we can access this, it will make us a better Buddhist, a better Christian, a better Jewish person, a better Muslim, a better Hindu, a better Confucian, a better whatever, a better person. That's the whole point of this. And I really like that quote from the Tao because it highlights virtue. It says, virtue is kind. And I want to begin today by highlighting virtue, by highlighting ethical conduct. Because we don't do the formal practice of cultivating loving kindness in a vacuum. It's a three-dimensional whole, requiring that we engage the entirety of our lives, integrating all aspects of our life. As the chant we've been doing in the evening, the metta indeed, speech and thought implies. Here we cultivate metta in thought, but there is also metta in speech and metta in deed. So virtuous conduct is in and of itself a metta practice. Sayadaw in the last days has described metta, has laid out the basic practice in quite a lot of detail. has described how we cultivate metta. So I want to begin today by backing up a little bit and describing more fully something he doesn't describe because it's so much ingrained in the culture in Myanmar that it goes without saying, and this is about sila, ethical conduct. We begin the practice at the beginning of the retreat, and we chant every day at the beginning of the talk these ethical precepts, these 9 precepts. They are the ground and foundation of the entire practice. Here that's assumed, it's known. In the West, often on retreats, we get exposed to some of these precepts, usually not all 9, but usually at least 5. And at the beginning of the retreat, often they're chanted together, and there's a little lip service often to the precepts. But they're not in any way described in detail. They're not usually emphasized. There are exceptions to this, of course. But often, it's just something that you do at the beginning of the retreat. You take the precepts, and then the practice is what's important. Here, it's understood that the precepts are part of the practice. When we chant the precepts together, this is not a mere religious recitation. It's actually a practice that offers, internally and externally, that offers safety, security, and a deepening and a broadening of the metta practice. The very first precept, I undertake the training. Well, hear that language. I really love that. I undertake the training. In other words, it's a practice. This isn't a law that we must obey, but these precepts are something we undertake as a practice, consciously, taking them to heart, reflecting about them, learning about the heart from them, learning about ourselves from them, and deepening in them. So I undertake the training to refrain from harming living beings. This is explicit metta. And we have so many opportunities through the day to use this as practice. When a mosquito lands on us, what do? The reflex is often to just, you know, oops. Maybe we have a habit of doing that. And maybe we break the precept. I undertake the training. So if we break a precept unintentionally out of habit, then we simply begin again. So, intention is what matters here. If you accidentally step on a caterpillar, or what have you, you're not breaking the precept. But if you see the mosquito on your arm and decide anyway you're going to kill it, that's breaking the precept. But it doesn't mean you fall into some hell realm as a result. This is simply a place to begin again. Feel what you feel having done that. And take the precept up again. So the very first precept is about harming. And when we all together take this precept, What a beautiful thing it is, really. I mean, think about it. Everybody in this room has taken up the practice of being harmless. This is a safe place. In this world, that is no small thing. And it's so important in the metta practice, because the only way the heart will open is if it feels safe. If we feel safe, the heart can open. So this very first precept offers that. Likewise, the second precept, not taking something that is not yours. Oh, the third precept, in the context of the retreat, not engaging in any sexual activity whatsoever, intentional sexual activity, which means we can live together as a community, knowing no one's going to hit on us. As nuns, we're safe from that, but as a layperson, not necessarily. But we're safe from that. And so on. Each of these precepts offers a deepening of that container of safety. And they're incredibly precious, because just as they offer external safety, they offer the heart internal safety, so that there's no, as long as we're holding the precept, there's no remorse on account of something we do on account of unskillful action. Often on retreat, what shakes the mind most can be something that we've done maybe 20 years ago that we've completely forgotten about, that was really unskillful. And the full force of the memory can come while we're quietly minding our own business, cultivating loving kindness. And it can really shake us. So as long as we hold these precepts, as long as we take up this training, we're free from that. And we just have to ride out the consequences from before, of maybe when we weren't. And the more we feel this safety, the more important these precepts become, because we actually see for ourselves the consequences of wholesome action, the beautiful consequences. My preceptor in this nun's life was Seiroji Upandita. And he liked to say, after he would offer the precepts, including the precept of not adorning oneself, he liked to say, "Now you are ordained or adorned with the garland of Sila." It's beautification for the mind and the heart. There's nothing better than that. And so when we take up the precepts consciously every day, we're adorning the mind, and we're giving ourselves a safe and stable place from which to do formal practice, sitting, walking, formal cultivation, explicit cultivation of loving kindness. So I would encourage you to reflect about the precepts, to really explore them as a practice. Notice which precepts you find easy, which precepts you struggle with. This is information. It tells you where your edges are. And there's no need to do anything with that except to continue the practice. You don't have to fix yourself with these precepts. You just have to undertake the training and go from there. So these are the precepts we chant every day. In addition to this explicit training in ethical conduct, it's important to consider our general attitude. That habitual way we respond to ourselves and to other people and the world around us. How are we in the world? And here it's really worth looking at the Metta Sutta, like the English Metta Sutta we chant every day, because the very beginning of the Metta Sutta, before it describes, you know, metta itself, before it even goes there, there's this whole list of qualities. Qualities of heart and mind that support the metta, that are onward leading, skillful means that provide the best conditions for the seeds of metta to grow. So we chant this when we chant the Metta Sutta. And it's really common to just gloss over this because we want to jump straight to the metta. Go to the meat of the sutta in the middle and forget the beginning part. But the Buddha didn't use words carelessly. He didn't just go blah, 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 this isn't important, blah, blah, blah. Every word means something. And actually, this whole teaching in the Metta Sutta is quite condensed. So I want to spend a little bit of time at the very beginning of this because it's really worth reflecting about. It says at the beginning, in the version that we chant, the translation that we chant from the Thai forest tradition, this is what should be done by one who's skilled in goodness and who knows the path of peace. Right away, people often go, ugh, because there's that word should in there. And many of us don't like that word one bit. What do you mean this is what I should do? Don't tell me what to do. But here's another translation that's actually more linguistically accurate. This is what's done by one skilled in what's good, who reaches toward that most peaceful state. This is a translation by Andy Olensky, who, at the time that he did this translation, was at the Barry Center for Buddhist Studies in America. He's a Pali scholar and a wonderful translator. So this is what's done by one skilled in what's good, who reaches toward that most peaceful state. The word here that I like so much is skill. Practice, again. This describes both the end result of the practice and the nascent beginning starting point that gets more and more continuous, pervasive, and refined. This is where we begin and where we end. So as Andy has translated it, this is what's done by one who's skilled in what's good. So this is a description of somebody who has skill with this and how they are. And you can drive yourself a little crazy with questions, which came first, the chicken or the egg? As I said, we start with a glimmer of this. We polish it. We develop it with the practice. We develop this skill. We refine this skill. We deepen it. until it's got momentum and power. So the description is of one who is at that place already, and this is what we develop along the way. So what follows from that is, let them be able and upright. The alternate translation that Andy offers is capable and straight, quite straight. And that straight, quite straight, is a literal translation of the Pali, ujucha, sujucha. The Buddha put that in there twice for emphasis. The emphasis being on honesty, internal honesty with ourselves, external honesty with each other. It's really important to be straight with ourselves. And it's really hard, because we all have ideals. We all know where we want to go with this. And often we try to fit ourselves into that ideal and feel that we come up short, and then we judge ourselves. But this is a practice. So to be straight in this context means to be honest with ourselves where we are, right here and right now. I'll have more to say about that because it's really important. But I want to just go on to cover the text. So the next line is straightforward and gentle in speech. Alternatively, the other translation, well-spoken, gentle, without too much pride. This points to humility. Again, it's another articulation of being who we are and not being anything more than that. And then there's a number of qualities that all point to both humility and simplicity. Humble and not conceited, contented and easily satisfied, unburdened with duties and frugal in their ways, peaceful and calm and wise and skillful, not proud or demanding in nature. So content with little, easily maintained, not doing too much and lightly engaged, thoughtful, modest, without greed amongst worldly things. This is basically the other translation. So humility and simplicity. And really letting in the importance of these things. Because when we're honest, when we're humble, when we're simple in our needs, we're not a burden to ourselves or to others. We can practice well because we're not trying to be someone we're not to ourselves or anyone else. So really to pause here and emphasize the main takeaway from these lines altogether, being that gentle and tenacious honesty that really is content with inner and outer conditions. And as Westerners, really, it's something to reflect about, because we can be very demanding, beginning with ourselves. So to reflect of what are you demanding of the practice? What are you demanding of yourself? And really holding that lightly, because we come here to develop metta, not to be perfect at the very beginning. So please don't demand perfection of yourself. Not at the beginning, not any time in the practice. Because that's harsh. That's discontent. But just to be gentle, kind, content with what is arising, rather than to demand perfection. You can let yourself off that perfection hook right now. It's okay. It is really okay. Whatever is arising. The practice can be completely messy. And we don't consciously come here on retreat to, you know, okay, I'm going to come on retreat and sit down and from the very first sitting have perfect practice. We don't consciously think that. But it's so ingrained in our cultures. Some cultures more than others. And now in the world of Twitter and Instagram and everything else, it's become so important to project a perfect life. That only adds to the pressure. So one of the gifts of time on retreat by yourself is that there's no pressure. You don't have to be anyone other than who you are in this moment. You don't have to be perfect. You just have to be and cultivate kindness. And so, having said all this, the Buddha then says, he gets to the last line in this beginning section, which deals more explicitly with ethical conduct. He says, let them not do the slightest thing that the wise would later reprove. And it's a paradox because, okay, be who you are, don't worry about perfection, and then, boom, one would not do even the slightest thing that others who are wise would speak against, which speaks to carefulness about conduct. And this last line is actually quite a high bar, but not to forget. This is the description of the perfected one, the ideal, one who has developed the heart to the point of proficiency and skill. So again, we start where we are, but at least having heard this, we know the direction to go. And carefulness about conduct, carefulness about sila, is naturally developed in the breaking of the precepts. This is the paradox. Because when we break a precept and then stop and feel how that feels, it's not very nice. It's like, I shouldn't have done that. And there's nothing wrong with remorse. We don't have to go to guilt or recrimination. Just feel the unpleasantness. This is what protects us in the future from doing it again. This is actually a useful mind state. It's not self-judgment. It's not beating ourselves up. It's just feeling. It's like, oh, that doesn't feel very nice. It's enough just to feel that. And then to take up the precepts again. And so maybe the next time we see the ants, we don't just step on them intentionally. It's like, oh, never mind, they're just ants. No, we go, oh, hi, guys, and we move around. We don't just slap that mosquito. We blow it off. This is how we develop that skill in ethical conduct. So we gradually get there by breaking the precepts, by making mistakes, and feeling how that feels, and letting that inform our behavior in the future. We gradually get there, and it's a long journey full of sidetracks. So not to be concerned when you make mistakes, when things go up and down. We're human beings, not machines. And that's the bottom line here with the entire practice. Life is what it is. We are as we are in this moment, depending on conditioning, conditions, previous actions, karma. And the cultivation of metta really doesn't mean denying that or pretending otherwise. It's not fake. It's not pretending we're perfect or wishing that the world is perfect. The world's not perfect. The world will never be perfect. This is samsara. It's not supposed to work. So it is what it is. We can't paper over the problems of the world with kind of magical thinking. And metta is not that. But what metta is it reforms how we respond to that. This is what the metta practice deals with, not outer conditions. So based on this ethical conduct and our general attitude and skill in that, we walk the way of metta. It's heart work here. And we cultivate metta here, right in our own hearts. No matter what is happening for other people, no matter what is happening in the outer world. So that eventually, when we have skill in the metta, no matter what is happening out there, we have the ability ourselves here in the heart to access and to connect with a heart that's friendly, full of care, full of tender kindness, full of benevolence, no matter what. This is also a high bar. It's really a high bar. I mean, not to deny the challenge of this, because the mind and heart is clouded by conditions, by conditioning, by habit. And the entirety of the practice is to undo that, to form a new habit, a habit of metta, as opposed to habits of greed, habits of hatred, and habits of delusion. So we start this practice with the qualities that bring us here, and that's good enough. And the road goes on from there. And the way of metta uses this really ridiculously simple technique. It's what we use to find metta, where we can most easily access it at the beginning, which is why when we develop the metta in this tradition, we start where it's easy and we get progressively harder using these categories that Saito has already described. And this easy category is a place to use as a refuge, a place to rebalance when things get challenging. It's not a linear sequence that you must follow rigidly. No, it's more circular. We breathe in, we breathe out. We follow the heart where it is right now with this courageous, gentle honesty. Sometimes it's easier to cultivate loving kindness for a benefactor. Fine, that's where we abide in the practice. Sometimes it's another category, and that's fine. That's where we abide in the practice. And using this phrase being a tool, a means to an end rather than the end in itself. And it's not a mantra. It's only useful in finding a way to actually connect with that metta heart, that well-wishing, that wish for the welfare and benefit of living beings. I tend to think of it as a compass needle pointing us in the right direction, showing the way forward. Oh, well, happy and peaceful, go in that direction. So we use this phrase and we connect with the meaning of it as much as we can. Not in a forceful way, but simply remembering. These words are not difficult. You know, we don't have to be rocket scientists to understand. Well, happy, peaceful. So using the phrase in however you need to use it to connect with that meaning, it may be slowing it down, it may be simplifying it. But using it as a skillful means. And we'll have a lot more to say about how the practice unfolds, about some of the challenges about doing it. But just to say in this context, really to emphasize flexibility, because this ongoing cultivation of heart and mind, using the phrases, using the categories, it's a cultivation of loving honesty that can connect and care no matter what, internally and externally. So when metta is present, the heart and mind are flexible, able to connect with whatever is happening to us and around us. When metta is present, there is not a rigidity or a fixed sense of the way things have to be internally and externally. There's no fixity on the right way to practice. There's just what is. So again, please don't think you have to progress through the categories in a linear and direct way or in a hurry. The path is cyclical and at times meandering. The basic instruction, the bottom line in this entire practice is to start where it's easy and go from there. And use the momentum you build where it's easy to deal with the edges in the heart. Because when we do this practice, we see where the edges of our metta are. A number of you already are describing this. It's like, whoa, I didn't know that was in there. We find all our edges in this practice, if we're doing it correctly. And we keep going with that. These edges where we can't go with the metta. And that's actually a very good thing. This is what those categories are there to reveal. And what they allow us, and what this patient, persistent cultivation allows us to transcend. So please just keep going patiently by again and again and again and again turning the heart towards this metta. And learning and relearning over and over the skill of opening to it. This is a journey that we do, a path that we walk one step at a time. It's not a race. It really, really, really does not matter how long it takes. Please let that in. I'll say it again. It doesn't matter how long it takes. There are only winners in this practice. The first person to get there isn't necessarily the winner. We're all winners when we can cultivate this, when we can learn to access this. And we all arrive in the end. And when we do, we realize it's the journey that matters. Because the paradox is at the end of the metta practice, the end of that journey is right here in this very life, right where we started. The same place as we were in the beginning, but seen through a different lens, seen through a metta lens, effortlessly, when we have that skill and we develop that skill. So I want to close with a quote that I just was very touched by. One of our friends in this Metta in Action group that we have, Narayan Levinson, just wrote a book called The Magnanimous Heart, which she published last year. And this is how she describes metta. She says, "Metta practice is a practice of unlocking, reminding, and awakening. The practice of metta is not an effort to convince ourselves of anything. It's not an effort to pretend, plead, or demand. It is tapping into what we really are, which is pure love." itself. So thank you for your kind attention, and thank you for your practice.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.